Water cyanobacteria, harmful algal blooms, response efforts with Ms. Catherine Carter. What? That's what I said, number three. Sure. I totally was thinking three.
A little rusty.
I'll tell you, there's a lot of pressure over here.
If the table feels empty, I can invite some people to sit up with me, if it's just me.
You don't want us over there.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Good afternoon, Catherine.
Hi, good afternoon, Vice Chair Noren and members of the board. My name is Catherine Carter. I'm a member of your staff in the Adaptive Watershed Management Unit, and I'm also the lead staff in our office who is working on developing a program and working on a program to establish this, the Cyanobacteria Harmful Algal Bloom Monitoring and Response Program. I'm fortunate enough to get to work on this with a couple really great other staff folks. Clayton Krager, our Watershed Stewardship Coordinator, works on this also with me. And Rich Fadness, our Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program Coordinator, works on it also. And today I'll be giving you an overview of the work that we've done so far. I'll start with just giving a general overview of cyanobacteria harmful algal blooms, kind of some background about what they are, followed by talking about the efforts that both the state and the federal government are doing to address this issue in our region and in the state. I'll also talk about our office's outreach and coordination efforts and the beginning of the building of our program. I just want to mention that cyanobacteria is synonymously called blue-green algae, so I've noted it up here. It is, in fact, though, a bacteria, and so I'm going to try to remember to use the correct term today, but sometimes you'll hear folks refer to blue-green algae, and they're talking about the same subject. Oops. That's better. To start, algae and cyanobacteria are billions of years old. They've been around a very, very long time, and they're a natural component of our aquatic ecosystems. They perform many vital roles in our environment. They're a food source, and they also produce oxygen, so they're very important to our ecosystems. However, when certain conditions are favorable, algae and cyanobacteria can rapidly multiply, causing blooms in our water bodies. It's important to note that not all blooms that occur are harmful, as only a very few number of cyanobacteria and algae are capable of producing toxins. Harmful algal blooms, or HABs, as they're referred to in a shorthand, occur when these algae and cyanobacteria that are capable of producing toxins rapidly multiply in a water body and accumulate. These HABs do have the potential to affect our beneficial uses and threaten public health as well as that of our livestock, our domestic animals, and wildlife. Harmful algal blooms are more likely to occur in warmer months, in warm, slow-moving water, and climate change and the recent drought conditions that we've had have certainly exacerbated this condition recently in the past few years. Nutrients from non-poised sources are also a factor that contribute to these blooms and are something that we are actively working to control through our various programs. Harmful algal blooms occur in our freshwater lakes and rivers, which is when I get to these pictures. This first photo is taken from Iron Gate Reservoir up on the Klamath River, and it shows a reservoir bloom, a floating cyanobacteria called Microcystis. These blooms occur every year. Blooms also occur in our rivers. This is a picture from the Eel River. And what you see, the very bright green, kind of vibrant colored, is actually a harmless filamentous algae. While it can look very bright and alarming, it is actually not toxin-producing. But underneath it, growing on the substrate, the more kind of a gray-green color, are cyanobacteria that do have the potential to produce toxins. Also, an emerging one we're seeing are golden algae. This is a picture from a lake in Texas because I couldn't get any from California, but they do occur in lakes in Southern California, and they have the potential to cause massive fish kills. So these are all the types of blooms that we could potentially see.
Hey, Catherine, can I ask you a question?
From
a massive fish kill standpoint, is it a low DO condition or is it a toxicity condition?
It's a toxicity. It releases a toxin that affects the fish and kills them.
Okay, thank you.
You also, these can occur in our marine environments. You might have recalled news reports over the last year or so about the what they termed the blob off the coast, which is a warm water mass that was causing some algae blooms in the water. It was producing, these blooms were producing domoic acid, which is a neurotoxin, and it's the one that caused the shutdown of both the rock crab and the Dungeness crab fishery, which, or crabbery, which only fully opened this past May. So it has effects all over. And although these do occur in the ocean and they can be caused by algae, I'm going to be focusing today on what the state is focusing on, which are those that occur in freshwater and are caused by cyanobacteria. The toxins produced by cyanobacteria are termed cyanotoxins, and each of them produce different health effects. There are four main categories of toxins, and they are dermatoxins, which affect the skin and can cause rashes or allergic reactions. There are hepatotoxins, which affect the liver, as well as cytotoxins, which affect the kidneys. And these have more long-term chronic buildup effects. They can accumulate in the food chain, and therefore the effects of these are generally longer term, are not noticed until the longer term. There are also neurotoxins, which affect the nervous system. These are generally extremely fast-acting and can lead to paralysis, seizures, or death. Sometimes the effects on animals can be very quick to notice and very dramatic and apparent, such as dog deaths from neurotoxins. These are immediate and dramatic. They usually are seizures followed by immediate death. It's important to know that dogs are especially affected by these because there's something about the cyanobacteria that the dogs like the smell of, and they will preferentially seek it out in a system and eat it. Dog autopsies have shown stomachs full of cyanobacteria, so they will preferentially seek it out. They also lick their fur when they get out of the water, and that generally breaks the cells, which can release toxins. So that's, I think, the reason that we hear of them so commonly as the animals affected by these outbreaks. Sometimes the effects, though, of these toxins are more subtle. This picture is from an article by Melissa Miller of California Department of Fish and Wildlife Veterinary Center and others, and it investigated the cause of sea otter deaths in Monterey Bay that you may have heard about several years ago. It was determined the cause of deaths was liver damage, and you can see the yellowing of the gums and the bones here is a sign of liver damage. And it was determined that was caused by what they called microcystin intoxication, which was most likely coming from consumption of the bivalves that were accumulating the toxins in the bay. So what was happening, they found, was that Pinto Lake was having a bloom. It was flowing into the river and then flowing into the bay, accumulating in the shellfish, and then ultimately killing the sea otters. So it's just good to be aware that these blooms and the toxins can be transferred from freshwater to marine systems. Human health effects include rashes, vomiting, and seizure. And it's very important to note that boiling does not get rid of these toxins. It will actually break up cells and release toxins if they're present in the water. It's also important to know that many drinking water treatment systems are not set up to filter for these toxins. You may recall hearing about Lake Erie a couple of years ago that experienced a large cyanobacteria bloom, which shut down the drinking water supply for the city of Toledo, Ohio, for 3 days. And they had to keep it shut down until toxins were no longer detected because our system did not have a mechanism to filter or treat for the toxins. So as part of our outreach program, we're actively coordinating and working with our Division of Drinking Water so that we can notify them when we do see cyanobacteria or have toxins present so that they can help guide us and they can provide outreach to drinking water in communities as appropriate. Different types of cyanobacteria produce different toxins, and many of them are capable of producing multiple toxins. So it's important for us to understand what different species of cyanobacteria may be present in our system so we know what toxins to look for. There are many types of harmful algal bloom forming cyanobacteria, but the most three of the most common I have noted on this slide, and they are Anabaena, Aphanizomina, and Microcystis. They're playfully known as Annie, Fanny, and Mike, which you may have heard. Anabaena has been found in the Russian River and in the Eel River, and it can produce the liver toxin microcystin. It can also produce two types of neurotoxins, anatoxin A and saxitoxin. And anatoxin A is the one that is commonly the culprit in dog deaths. Aphanizomina has been found in some of the smaller recreational ponds in our region, including Spring Lake here in Santa Rosa. It's also present in Upper Klamath Lake, and it is capable of producing the neurotoxin anatoxin A, as well as the liver and kidney toxin Cylindris bromopsin. Microcystis is found commonly in the Klamath River and its reservoirs, and it produces the liver toxin microcystin. I want to note that these are only three of the many kinds of cyanobacteria there are, but I just wanted to give an example that they are varied and they can produce multiple toxins. It's important to know the only way to know if toxins are present in the water is to do testing, because while not all cyanobacteria are capable of producing toxins, and secondly, those that are don't do so all the time. So it's a bit of a complex issue, because even if they're present and they're capable of producing toxins, they may not be. So really, water testing is the only way to know for sure. This is an issue that is occurring worldwide. It's all over the country, and so it's not unique to our region. Within our region, those areas where we have documented occurrences of blooms and animal and human health effects, they're noted on this slide in the red. The Klamath River, including Kopco up here in Iron Gate Reservoir, is listed on the 303D list of impaired waters for microcystin, that's the liver toxin, and it has recurrent blooms every year. There was also a documented dog death in Kopco Reservoir a few years ago. In 2014, the Humboldt County Department of Environmental Health received a report of a person exhibiting some dermal effects after recreating in the Trinity River at Kimtoo Beach, which is near Willow Creek. And so they did end up posting a health advisory and doing some testing, and they found both the neurotoxin and anatoxin A, and they also found, they found microcystin, which is a liver toxin. So they kept that advisory up until the water was free of those toxins. Humboldt County Department of Health Services is aware of at least 12 confirmed dog deaths, and they've ranged in their region from up here at Big Lagoon and the Van Dusen River, as well as on the Eel River below Lake Pillsbury, with the majority of the reports, though, being on the South Fork Eel River. There were also two confirmed reports of dog deaths on the Russian River occurring last year, one of which was shown, you know, you probably saw it in the newspaper, and the other one was not reported until this has become a more recent topic of discussion. I want to note that this map only shows those confirmed cases. It's very challenging to make a positive confirmed link between cyanotoxins and health effects of animals and of humans. And a lot of that is because outreach and education is only in the beginning stages. So I expect as we educate folks more on this subject, work with our county partners more, that we may find we have more reports and it's more common than we're realizing. There's currently no federal criteria for cyanotoxins in either drinking water or in ambient water. Although the US EPA has established drinking water health advisories for microcystin and Cylindris bromopsin, and this is the first step towards them creating what would be an enforceable criteria for us. They're also in the process of creating criteria for recreation for microcystin and Cylindris bromopsin. And having those criteria will be very helpful in allowing us to have a value against which we can regulate a kind of an enforceable number. The federal government also has created an interagency federal work group that's developed a research plan and an action strategy for assessing HABs in the U.S., and they've come out with this report. This plan includes recommendations for future research on toxin testing and on forecast modeling, as well as recommendations to help develop tools for early detection of these harmful algal blooms and to better study and understand both the human and the animal health effects from them. On the part of the state, California has developed a freshwater harmful algal bloom assessment and support strategy, which has three main components. There's event response, ambient monitoring, and risk assessment. As part of this strategy, the state is developing a centralized website where people can report any events or anything they notice in their rivers. It'll also be used for data storage and information dissemination. So that will be very helpful for public outreach. This summer, they're offering several training courses for people to become better at identifying and being able to respond to cyanohabs, and those are taking place all over the state. The state's also working on new methods of early detection. They're working with NOAA on assessing satellite imagery to do an early detection of bloom, when blooms may be occurring in some of our larger reservoirs and lakes. So that's going to be exciting new technology for us. Also, our office is taking the lead on conducting tests on a new laboratory method that involves doing a genetic analysis of the cyanobacteria to determine if it has a particular gene which would indicate it's capable of producing a toxin, so we can better focus which samples should be sent to the lab for this very costly analysis. The state also reconvened a statewide work group called the California Cyanohab Network, and our office regularly participates in that group. Members of the work group are working on several event response guidance documents, including doing updates to the draft 2010 voluntary guidance for responding to cyanohabs in recreational water bodies. The 2016 updates just came out in February, and they have improved the value of this document to a very high level, so it's really been improved dramatically. For one thing, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment evaluated data and information on both the animal and the human health effects from the different toxins, from three of the most common ones, those being microcystins, anatoxin A, and cylindrospermopsin, and they developed numeric triggers that are shown here. And each of these triggers is associated with a different probable or possible health effect. And when those triggers are met, it would result in the posting of one of these three signs, with the caution sign being sort of like an informational posting that there may be an issue in these waters, moving up through all the way to the danger sign, where if you have a high enough level, it'll close a water body to both human recreation and to animals.
Hey, Catherine, can I ask you a question before you move that off that slide? Can you give us a sense? Those are parts per billion numbers, microgram per liter. So can you give us a sense of range of concentrations that have been found, say, like in a Klamath, South Fork Eel, Russian River system? Order of magnitude type of thing?
Sure. So the Klamath has had many orders of magnitude of microcystin detection over this.
Into the hundreds.
Okay.
The eel and the Russian, we don't have that answer yet, because the eel, as I'll go into, does not have a history of doing monitoring. They just have a history of posting. And the Russian River, we're going to start really investigating with that and the eel this year. So we may have a better idea after this year.
Great. Thank you.
The last part of the updates, this is a really very hard to see picture, but what it's showing is that there's been a flow chart that's developed to help people who are using the guidance document. And the flow chart leads from the top of when to start monitoring. It leads you through when to post at these different levels, and it also gives guidance on when removal of postings is warranted. So it's really helped people utilizing the guidance to know when posting is warranted and also when it can be taken down. In addition to participating in all these various statewide programs, our office has also been busy developing a program and doing our own efforts in our region in order to facilitate collaboration and partnerships and start education and outreach. In February, we hosted a workshop and a work group meeting. The workshop was really well attended by over 60 people, and we shared information and background on cyanohabs, as well as laboratory methods for treatment, drinking water methods for treatment, ways to monitor, and gave some case studies to help kind of start the education of our region. The second day was a work group meeting for those who may have some sort of a role to play in monitoring or response of this subject, and we had really good representation. We had representatives representing the Russian, the eel, the Klamath and Spring Lake, as well as Van Dusen, South Fork, Yale, and Trinity. And so it was a great forum from which we began the conversation of building partnerships and having a conversation about the next steps that we would follow. Since that workshop and workgroup meeting, we've been actively meeting with many focused groups and developing our program in our region to help build our partnerships. As a first step in building our partnerships, we're going to be focusing on those areas of our region that have those known documented cyanohab events, and those are shown here on the slide. Each of these water bodies has a varying level of a monitoring and response program in place, with the Klamath River having the most well-formed history and program for monitoring and posting and response. The Eel and South Fork, Eel, Van Dusen, and Trinity do not have a history of having monitoring conducted, but they do have a history of outreach to the public and postings. And the Russian River, we only recognized this to be an issue last year, so we're beginning the process formally this year of developing that program with our county partners. As I mentioned, the Klamath River and Reservoirs has the most well-formed, robust program. I've been in contact with the deputy director of the Siskiyou Environmental Health Department, as it is the public and environmental health county entities that have the authority to authorize postings and depostings in water bodies. Has been the history, they have asked and requested that our office maintain the role of authorizing postings. And so given that the board has approved a resolution to give us that authority, we do plan on continuing that role in Siskiyou County. I've had meetings and conversations with those responsible for monitoring and response and posting in the basin, and everyone has agreed to utilize these guidance updates and utilize similar signs and thresholds, as similar as possible on the thresholds, so that we can have consistent-looking postings along the river, so they're recognizable to members of the public who may be moving along the river or from one river to another. Monitoring has already begun, and there are biweekly reports that we receive. They're also posted on the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program website under their blue-green algae tracker. This is a fantastic tool and resource for information for members of the public who are wondering what the current status of the water body is. And should results come back that warrant potentially having the areas posted, we're in communication with those entities and we will advise them as appropriate. Clayton asked that I note that he has been able to form this really amazing monitoring program over the years based on consistent but very modest funding that has had to come from multiple sources. And it's really been a key to the longevity of this program, and it's something that every year Clayton and Randy Turner, the coordinator of the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program, and others have to really try to find funds to continue this program so they can have a useful informational program that informs both us and the public. So kudos to Clayton and Randy. For the South Fork Eel, Eel River, Van Dusen, and Trinity Rivers, and we're just in the beginning process of building teams and building partnerships there. Clayton Rich and I have met with members of Humboldt and Mendocino Environmental Health and a representative from Lake County Public Health, and we've discussed coordinating posting efforts on these rivers. Especially on the Eel River, where all three have jurisdiction. And we're also discussing plans with Humboldt County for posting on other rivers. The representatives of these three counties have really been grateful for this kind of coordinated approach and for our kind of guidance and advice on this subject matter. They've agreed to form a work group to help share ideas and resources, and it's already become a really fruitful ground for information sharing with the counties benefiting from sharing their informational and outreach materials with one another, sharing ideas. We're also currently working on a joint press release with the three counties as a precautionary kind of press release to the public to let them know that these water bodies have histories of blooms and that they should be aware and some healthy habits they could follow to help decrease their risk of exposure. So it's already become a really great tool, and we expect it's going to continue in the future. Due to limited budgets, and because the lab analysis for cyanotoxins is incredibly expensive, the counties do not have a history of doing any actual monitoring in these water bodies. They generally will post the water bodies early in the season. That's going to be happening in the next month. They have agreed to use and post these first level of sign, the caution sign from the guidance updates. And they do it as an informational posting, and they also release healthy habits to follow and materials and outreach to both veterinarians and doctor's offices. So the county's protocol is to test if and when they get a report of something like a dog death. Then they will go out, or the human health effects, the dermal effects that were experienced on the Trinity. They'll go out and they'll do monitoring until conditions do not warrant monitoring as required anymore. So this is a challenge and something that we're actively looking to see if we can encourage them to think about for next year, maybe trying to have a pilot program to see if they can try to better document conditions so that they can more accurately reflect the level of potential issue that may be out there. Another way our office is building partnerships in these rivers is we're working with the Eel River Recovery Project, which has been conducting cyanotoxin monitoring on the Eel River for the past several years under the direction of Keith Balma-Gregson, who is a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley. Rich Fadness of your staff has been working with Mr. Balma-Gregson and the Eel River Recovery Project to coordinate monitoring so that we can get more information over a wider area. And I want to note that so the data that has and is being collected involves deployment of these, they're called SPAT bags, which stands for Solid Phase Adsorption Toxin Tracking. And what it is it's sort of like a tea bag with a resin in it, and it acts as a passive sampler. So as the water flows by, the toxins will adhere to the resin. So, you know, every 2 weeks they'll be collected and evaluated. And the data from these is valuable in that it provides us with a time-integrated sampling that tells us which toxins are present. It'll tell us both, if the toxins are present in different areas of the river as well as what are present, but we can't use the values to inform the various posting levels because it is a time-integrated sample. It will only tell us kind of, you know, like a cumulative maximum value versus any point in time what one would be exposed to. So this is valuable information in some ways, but we could still use some real grab sample regular monitoring out there. We are going to be sharing this information with the counties, and we're also hoping to help them build a partnership with the Eel River Recovery Project, because you never know, perhaps in the future they could find some way to provide some funding to that group and they could help with monitoring. So we're always looking for opportunities to help people build their programs. For the Russian River, in early May, our office hosted a Russian River CyanoHab coordination meeting, which was attended by the Sonoma County Water Agency, Sonoma County Parks, and the Sonoma County Department of Public and Environmental Health. It was a really good meeting, and the wonderful outcome of that meeting was that all the different organizations decided that we could utilize our programs and a lot of the information we're already collecting, as well as some new information, and share that with one another so that we can help track conditions on the Russian River this summer with respect to cyanobacteria. Sonoma County Public Health has been very proactive in taking a lead on the Russian River in both outreach and in public health monitoring, and also in response. So we're very happy to work with them. They've been a great partner. We've begun regular coordination emails, which will at some point be followed by regular coordination calls where we review the latest water quality conditions and determine the likelihood of there being cyanobacteria and whether we need to do monitoring or not. Sonoma County Water Agency is providing us with weekly water quality summaries of dissolved oxygen, temperature, and pH, information that is used for monitoring, like a precursor monitoring, to determine whether we think we have conditions that would promote aquatic growth, which would then trigger us to go out and do actual field sampling. The water agency is also going to be conducting biweekly sampling of algae and cyanobacteria in the river over the summer, and they're going to be helping to determine algal succession as well as what species of algae and cyanobacteria are present in the river. So that's going to help inform our knowledge base. Sonoma County Public Health has secured funding to be able to do a pilot public health monitoring program at 10 beaches over the summer. And this is going to be conducted weekly with monitoring. It will begin once the group determines that the conditions exist and we're seeing the beginnings of cyanobacteria growth. But that has not occurred yet at the present time. The monitoring has not been warranted. In order to complement their effort, our office is doing a pilot ambient monitoring program, which is going to be looking at conditions in between the beaches at about, I think it's 4 locations on the Russian River. We're going to be deploying those time-integrated spat bag samplers, as well as doing actual collection of water samples for both the genetic analysis and for toxin analysis. Say that Rich Fadness of our office has done a really great job of setting up our lab. We're going to be doing a pilot for the state to test an analysis that does that genetic determination to determine if the gene is present that shows that the bacteria could produce toxins. And so once again, we're kind of leading the way as a region, and the state is really looking to us to see if this technology works. They're going to be adopting the use of it in more places. We're also going to be conducting visual monitoring along the river, and we're going to be holding a training next month to ask some of our watershed partners, like Russian River Keeper and those who run different businesses on the river, to join us to learn how to do a preliminary identification of what cyanobacteria looks like versus a regular green algae, so that we can hear from them and they can help us narrow down and identify areas where we might want to be focusing our monitoring and response efforts. And also, we're going to be doing our outreach, continuing outreach. As an example, Brenda Edelman, who I saw is here today, has invited us to speak next week at the Russian River Watershed Protection Committee meeting. It's a technical meeting. Oh, thank you. So I'll be speaking at the Sonoma County Water Coalition meeting and just kind of giving an educational overview of the subject and answering any questions that come up. So in summary, I want to highlight some what I think are really important points. Cyanobacteria, they're a part of our natural environment, and they have been around for billions of years, as have their toxins. So they've been present worldwide. It's not just in our region, and this is not something that is a new issue. The conditions in our water bodies, however, as time has gone on and our water bodies have gotten out of balance, we've gotten to the conditions which are more likely to have these cyanobacteria harmful algal blooms and have cyanotoxins present in our system. The drought and climate change have certainly exacerbated these conditions, and unfortunately those are largely beyond our control. But we are working on using our existing programs to control factors such as nutrients from non-point source pollutions to control those factors that we can help to influence this. In order to provide effective response to these cyanohabs, it involves planning and coordination, which the development of this program is a reflection that we are doing that and we will continue to work on. We'll continue to evaluate the multiple lines of evidence, both the physical effects on the stream, like temperature and biostimulatory conditions, as well as looking at water samples. We'll also be doing visual assessments, which we think are useful, although on their own they would not be our sole reason for response. But we're going to continue working on a weight of evidence approach, and our ultimate goal being to keep water bodies open while still being protective of public health and of animals and wildlife. This contains my contact information. If you or anyone attending today has any questions, there are also a list of websites that are useful resources. I want to point out that for the Russian River, the Sonoma County Department of Health Services has a webpage dedicated to updating the latest conditions, and it also contains a list of healthy habits that one should practice when going to the river to minimize exposure, which just kind of involves common sense of rinsing off after you leave the water, making sure children's hands are clean, dogs are rinsed off, cleaning fish fillets with clean water. So there are things we can do to minimize our exposure when we're recreating that are really helpful. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Fantastic. Thank you, Catherine. Board Member Gisti.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Catherine, you know, I've spent half of my professional life over in Lake County working on Clear Lake, and Clear Lake is the poster child for cyanobacteria, going back to Alex Horn's work in the 70s. So offline, if I'd like to talk to you, I've got some contacts up there that might be helpful for people who have spent a great deal of their professional lives dealing with cyanobacteria. One of the things I know, and then the other thing I wanted to start off with, I really want to compliment you on using measured terminology. That is so important when talking about a scary topic to members of the public. This can come across as a very frightening issue to a lot of people, and I really appreciate you not using value-laden terms. That's really important to keep a strong scientific tone to your delivery, and I think you did an excellent job on that. What you've touched on, which is a really important part, I say it differently, but what I say that in nature, the concept of good and bad does not exist. In nature, there are simply consequences. The consequences you talk about are a changing climate. We can't talk about it in a future tense anymore. It is changing. Drought conditions. And in Clear Lake, since 1970, has gotten clearer. So light is affecting Ligmia, which is causing problematic blooms. So there's a lot of things we do to try and change the environment, and there's a reaction to those changes. So it's not good or bad. It's just how things work. The other challenges, too, that I've found from experience, you go out on Monday and you sample a slick and you find cyanobacteria toxins. You go out on Wednesday and sample the same slick and the toxins are gone. There's an on-off switch on these things somehow. And so, again, we need to temper, and you did a great job at tempering the level of concern. They're probably the original organisms that got started on this planet. You're right. They've been around forever, literally, and they are a component of the natural environment. So I really, you couldn't have done a better job the way you laid it out, and I just want you to hold tough on that because you're going to be talking in emotional situations, and the scientific delivery you presented really served you well today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Board Member Mitten.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. And thank you for your presentation. Very impressive how staff and partner agencies have rapidly evolved this program of monitoring response. I really appreciate that and acknowledge how important it is. Of course, the third leg is prevention of this stuff. And you talked about using existing programs, but is there discussion or evolving thinking among staff about other things that we could be doing to control the water quality factors and in-stream flow factors that are causing these harmful blooms?
We are working on coordinating with other programs in our office, like working with the cannabis program. So when they do their outreach, they can explain in part why it's so important for people to, what water withdrawals will do to a stream and what nutrient inputs will do to a stream. So we are working on that. And I would ask if Clayton has anything to add.
Clayton Krager of your staff. It's a very great question, Board Member Minton, because if you've recalled, we've talked in the past about our strategic teams that we've evolved to develop cross-program solutions for some of these emerging problems. And several of our teams are addressing these underlying causes for the emergence of these nuisance blue-green algae blooms, flow being amongst one of them. And that means partnership with our agencies that have a more direct nexus with improving flows, but there are ways we can work with our partners in the watersheds to do that as well. And in addition, we in our region, we have a lot of legacy impact to our rivers and streams that seem to be exacerbating this situation. Sedimentation of our rivers decreases the channel complexity, shallows the water, creates higher temperatures. And so we kind of view all of our work towards, you know, upslope controls of sediment, improving. Jonathan Warmer Dam is actively working with groups throughout our region to improve channel complexity through various restoration measures. We have a restoration strategic work group to try to increase the pace and scale of those types of projects. And then, of course, our watershed stewardship work group, which is working on watershed-wide solutions, because the blue-green algae really is reflective of the health of the entire watershed, not just the stream. So we do recognize sort of the fundamental issues involved here. And I just want to address the question about the uncertainty associated with this, is that Catherine emphasized in her presentation that we're using a lines of evidence approach. And that is because it is these blooms are very ephemeral. And not only that, you're now dealing with them in moving bodies of water. So it's very difficult to know when you have a situation that could be problematic for public health. And the consequences, we experienced it last year with the Russian River, can be pretty catastrophic economically. So what we didn't share with you, because it's pretty complex, but we're also working on our partners with, is a very detailed decision diagram for how we assess these lines of evidence to support them in making these calls on the postings and the advisories and potentially, you know, shutting of a water body. So it is one of those incredibly challenging things where we don't completely understand why the genes shut on and off. We don't understand from a single sample whether that represents, you know, a passing parcel of water that is, or whether it's continuing downstream, because our sampling is not continuous. So it gets into those kind of things. That's why we've been emphasizing the development of what we call precursor monitoring. We do know the factors that increase the probability of nuisance blooms, you know, temperature and nutrient concentration and diurnal fluctuations in pH and DO, and so that we can be, those are the types of lines of evidence that we're trying to enhance our ability to, when we do get a hit, to put it into context so that we can make the right call. But it's a call. It always will be.
Thank you.
Board Member Hill?
Thanks. And Clayton, I think it's just kind of underscored what Board Member Giusti and what Valerie were saying, and what you had just kind of reiterated is just kind of the complex nature of the beast. And we've got, our radar screen is on of where this is happening. We've got an improved focus on this and a coordinated effort, and so much work has been done and ground has been covered, you know, in the last few years since we've been kind of getting little spot reports about it and people talking about it. And so I'm very complimentary about that. And, you know, it's ambitious to be able to figure out the spatial and temporal dynamics, let alone, you know, within a system and outside into other systems. But I think it's extremely appropriate what you've done. And I really liked the graphics showing what the public notice and the public outreach are, and the postings for that. And I think just erring on the side of caution is the best way to do it. And so we've got partner agencies that were able to, you know, at least alert us, and we've got, you know, courses of action to do to, you know, warn folks about what's happening. So,
well, the reason I wanted Catherine to emphasize the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program is not because of, by the way, we have been the primary funders for that for several years, but it's that coordinated information collection and then handling that allows us to help address some of that uncertainty. I mean, improved consistency in analytical techniques, more spatial and temporal sampling because you've optimized your sampling network. And that's why we're working so hard to get that kind of program introduced to our other river basins, including the Russian River.
Right. It's a model program.
It's just a good example of that.
It's definitely a nice benefit of having gone through that development. Now you can actually apply that as a template elsewhere.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Can I ask you a question? So rapid assessment tools. I mean, when you're talking about taking a sample, Catherine, how, what's your laboratory turnaround? Because, say, like last summer in the Russian River system, there was a, I believe that that event happened right around the Jazz on the River weekend, and, mm-hmm. and of course, that's a tourist economy out there, and people become highly aware of the fact of the effects of that and their economics and their free use of a river system. When samples are taken by an entity, how long does it take to get this? How long are results coming back?
For samples that are sent to the lab, I'll let Rich speak to that. And then there are some things we can do in the field, though.
Yeah, Rich Fadness, staff here. The turnaround time generally for a is 24 to 48 hours. That's the quickest that we can get that.
Good.
So it's draft at 24 and up to 48 to 96 hours before it's final. But we do get the draft data quickly.
And Rich, from the standpoint, too, of developing your in-house to use a method or develop a method, I think is what I heard, an analytical test method here, is that similar to a PhyloChip or something like
QPCR.
That?
QPCR. Okay. So it's QPCR technology that actually they're using in Ohio right mm-hmm. now.
Yeah, so it replicates the genes so that we can see if there are enough copies of the gene that indicate that the bacteria may be producing toxin. And our hope is that eventually if we can run those tests here in this office, and sometimes you have cyanobacteria that are capable of producing toxins, but at that particular time they don't have a gene, then they're not going to be producing toxins, and we can save money on those analyses, and we can know a little bit more about how to post or not post our river system.
The other part of this too is that in some ways, you know, while these are naturally occurring organisms here, and that you mentioned the favorable conditions, right? Nutrient rich waters, there tend to be warm. Some of these are managed flow systems, particularly the Russian River. In fact, it's going towards potentially a different flow regime, a low flow regime. And my concern here is that we saw this last year. We saw it in a drought condition, which the drought condition surely was warm. It surely was low flow. And we know by our listings that we have nutrient impairment there. And that my concern is that in the managed flow regime that potentially is here or is coming as it's managed in the future, then what happens with this? The controllable factors that are here from the anthropogenic side of this equation. These organisms are naturally here, but the controllable factors and the dials that you could potentially turn as a controlling to mitigate those controllable factors. Surely we could have programs, a dairy program to control nutrients or cannabis or non-point source and point source stuff too on the flow side, you know, in the Russian River system, right? We're looking at that. The dams in the Russian River system, the Klamath system seem to be kind of the macrocosm of that, it seems to me. Those are shallow, they're warm, they're nutrient rich for sure. How do you see this factoring in then to the managed flow, whether it be the Russian River or other water systems? Those controllable factors, if they could be controlled in a favorable factor to mitigation. In essence, if you go or others go out and do monitoring and find that some of these factors, low DO or a pH condition or nutrient conditions are there, do you see potentially that some of those factors as control can also help to mitigate, offset, change the condition so that the impairment does not exist, if it does exist, that it's short-lived and ephemeral?
Sure. I think it's going to depend on the system, and I'll let Clayton speak to the Klamath. And in terms of the Russian, I think what we're doing is going to set the stage to see if that if flow is an issue. What we have to do first is collect the data and the information to see what conditions are now and how they're different from the way they used to be.
Yeah.
And then we can discuss with the entities, you know, the biological opinion and the flows associated with that, whether we need to revisit that because they may be beneficial for fish, but they're causing other issues in the river. We don't have that information at this time, so we really don't know if flows from the biological opinion are having an effect for the Russian River.
And that's a fair answer, by the way. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but it's a fair answer. Just that the factors here that are, in fact, controllable on the side of the equation of what you do about it is kind of where I'm going, whether it be the Russian system or any other system for that matter.
Yeah, with the Russian, you know, it's actually returning to the historical flow conditions to
That's right.
not push the young fish into the ocean too early. But so that, but you're right, we need to assess those changes relative to the watershed is no longer in pre-disturbance condition, and so there may be some unintended consequences. And I think we have a good monitoring and plan in place in partnership, well, led by the Sonoma County Water Agency, that is evaluating that. In the Klamath, they're run-of-river dams, and they are certainly the source of the vast majority of the blue-green algae, the cyanobacteria that we see in the river. And it is interesting, most regulated rivers are trying to return to as much as possible to a natural flow regime, something that simulates, but dams always hold back warm water, and they also hold back sediments, which has a scouring effect downstream, and we see a buildup of these. We're now seeing in our rivers, because of these low flows and such, we're seeing larger mats of regular attached periphyte and green algae that is becoming the habitat for some of these blue-green algae species, cyanobacteria species that typically did not grow well in flowing water, but the vast mats are becoming. So it's a changing dynamic from what we've had experience in the past. So even in the relatively unregulated systems, well, it's impacted by flow issues. The eel, we're seeing...
South Fork especially.
Yeah, yes. Right. And so, you know, and what we saw this year on the Klamath, and we're hoping that this is true for the Russian, but we don't have as much evidence as we do for the Klamath, is that we had some really good rains this year and sustained rains. And the dive team from Oregon State University that's been studying the parasite infestation on the Klamath, the polychaete, the freshwater worms that attach to the bottom, were completely scoured out of the system in terms of the most disease-laden areas. And so they're the intermediate host for the parasite. So there's hopes that this scouring event will help mitigate the effects that we've seen from the infection rates to this massive colony of polychaetes that forms because the dams have not allowed for these types of scouring events, which would, you know, basically cleanse the river of this. You know, those parasites have been present on the Klamath time immemorial as well. It's that we've upset the equilibrium by changing the flow conditions and the organic carbon conditions that have allowed this intermediate host to bloom to unbelievable proportions, and then therefore release super high concentrations of this infecting cyst that affect the salmon population. So you're right, it's managing rivers. We have a big responsibility, and we have a responsibility to understand the consequences of that. And, you know, I think that by and large, what's happening on the Klamath with dam removal is going to be good for the river.
One last question, Sue, and one, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to add that there is a possibility the Bureau has been open to, on the Klamath, reopening the biological opinion to look at some of these things, and now it would just, there was an article last month that there's actually a lawsuit filed to get them to do so because of the disease conditions, but to, so there are mechanisms by which data, including the cyanobacteria data, as well as information on things like disease, can affect changes at another level. So once we have the information, that's another avenue by which it is useful.
Well, as been stated by the other board members here, I believe that, you know, I think data is important. Data is the way to inform then the condition and inform then the changing condition of how this reacts and changes over time. And to get to that one very last question, Rich, you're the king of swamp, I believe, in our region.
That
and,
I am. Yes.
And that as that goes, does swamp then amend itself to include these then as a interbasin sampling or region-wide sampling? Do you see this statewide? Is it being considered as a, it sounds like this, we're not just the lucky ones to have this here. This is elsewhere and throughout the state and world, for that matter.
That's true. Many of the other regions are dealing with this as well. Region 2 is actually mirrored off of our work, the workshop that we had in February. They had their own, I think it was 2 months later, mirrored off of what we did. We were collaborating or speaking with them. The swamp program itself is working with the CCHAB. In fact, many of the regional coordinators are on the CCHAB, the
The statewide work group.
So SWAMP has noticed that this is an issue statewide, and we are moving forward with outreach and tools in order to do that.
Yeah, and I would say that we've been given approval this year to use SWAMP funds to do work in the Eel and the Russian, and it may be that the outcome of those results dictate what we do in future years, but funding is by far the limiting factor. Monitoring is the limiting factor, and we're going to be working over the next year to try to get the counties to put this as a priority for themselves and figure out ways we can help make the most of the resources that they have as well as our resources.
Well, and it strikes me you guys are the perfect team members to be out there participating with others. Thank you for your efforts very much. I wanted to very much recognize you, Catherine, not only for these efforts, but I saw in the executive officer report that I believe you're the king of the KFAT program. Actually, the queen of KFAT program.
That's right. King of SWAMP. I'm the queen of KFAT.
Right. Thank you for the correction. And I want to recognize your efforts. You were in the Columbia River Basin, and they're going to mirror off of you, it sounds like, up there, mirror off of that program, I should say.
Yeah, it was a wonderful opportunity to, as an amazing thing, the Columbia River looked to the Klamath River for guidance. And
cool.
They are moving forward, and they are asking us to continue helping them with their programs. So it's very exciting.
Well, very nice. Very nice. Thank you very much for your efforts and others, too, all the team members. I know it's not just us. I know Sonoma County Water Agency. I know the Public Health Department, Environmental Health. There was quite a stir down here last fall on this. So any other board questions?
Not a question, just a compliment. I think that was a great presentation, Catherine. And being the non-scientific person on the board, all my experience and exposure to the algae has been newspaper articles. And there is a big gap between the science and the newspapers. Yeah. And some way, it would be great to figure out a way to do outreach, because it was an excellent presentation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And just so you know, we are working ahead of the game this year in our different counties and with our partners to hopefully better inform the newspapers and what they are putting in their articles.
Yeah. Any other comments, questions for these guys? Do we have a speaker card? I believe Brenda Edelman has. Thank you very much, all of you. I appreciate it.
Very good.
Yes. Yeah. We will. Yep. Good afternoon, Brenda.
Brenda Edelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. Good afternoon, all of you. I, too, want to add my great admiration for this presentation and for your staff's work thus far, and nothing but compliments. Keep up the good work. Anyway, I just wanted to elaborate a little bit on things that were already mentioned by board members and staff. I've been working on this issue and concerned about for a very long time, and I'm really glad to see things happening now. And the three components that have been mentioned, I can just give you a few little brief details. The temperature at Johnson's Beach in Guerneville for years has averaged in the sunny summertime from 24 to 26 centigrade, which is impossibly high for fish. And it's consistent, and it starts to go down in September, it comes up in June, and all summer long it stays at about that level. In terms of the nutrient issue, feeding the algae, and I've taken many, many pictures. I take pictures every year. I have a long history of pictures of algae in the river. The Nutrient Water Agency, under the biological opinion, has been doing testing, weekly testing at about 14 different locations. And the phosphorus levels at all locations have been just about 100% out of compliance with EPA recommended levels. So we have a serious phosphorus problem in the lower river. Finally, in terms of flow, of course, the comments that David made and questions you asked were right on target in terms of management of flows in the Russian River. And one very key important piece of information that was not mentioned was that in the next month, by the end of July, there will be a major EIR coming out by the water agency that's actually 2 years late on changing flows permanently on the entire Russian River. And this is a very, very significant change. They have informed people there would be a 60-day comment period. And the changes in the lower river aren't even to directly serve the fish. They are to do a project that has been totally unsuccessful over the last 7 years to retain a lagoon at the mouth of the river. And in fact, I have the data to prove that it is totally not feasible during the months of July and August, where they have to have the river closed before they do the project, and the river has closed only, I may have these reversed, but in July only 3 times over the last 20 years and 5 times in August. I may have those numbers backwards. But there are very few closures during July and August, and yet they're talking about reducing the levels of the river by 45%, the minimum levels. So whereas now in a normal rain year, they keep the level, minimum level at 125 CFS, which isn't all that high. It's not like we have a flood of water going through. And they want to bring it down to 70. And I hope your agency will do. Now, the supervisors approve the EIR. I'm sure they will be expecting comments from your agency. And then it goes to the state board. And the state board are the ones to finally authorize changes in Decision 1610. So I just wanted to alert you that that's imminent. And it's critically important, maybe the most important thing that's happened over many years in terms of the river. And I think there are probably other things too, man-made conditions and circumstances that could be looked at greater breadth and depth to see what other changes may be affected to make this less of a problem. But in a perverse way, this problem may be a blessing in terms of the river, but I hope we don't have any more serious events, but I appreciate the attention you're all giving it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. Any questions or comments for Brenda? Thank you very much. I don't have any other further speaker cards here. We're going to take a 10-minute break. We'll be back at 10 to 3. Thank you very much for
it's you.
Four.